Hello and welcome to the inaugural episode of Cross Court Conversations, a podcast that aims to break the mold set by every other drab tennis podcast, which seems to be hosted by a version of my dad. Sitting across the court from me today, I've got my fellow host, Juan Manuel Sierra. Juan, how you doing?
Hey Jason, how's it going? It's good to finally be here on our first episode of Cross Court Conversations. We're going to talk about all things tennis, basically, from the newest news to maybe even some historical episodes, or who knows what we have up our sleeves. But it's just great to be here talking about a sport that, you know, we already talk about so much in our free time. So might as well make a podcast about it, right?
Yeah, we wouldn't be the first ones to do that, right?
Nah, surely it's the first time two dudes our age decide to make a podcast out of something they like. I don't think anyone's done that yet.
Never happened. But yeah, why don't we tell our audience before we launch into this episode, which is going to be a review of the 2024 season, which we're a little bit late to the party because we realize this is probably going to come out early 2025, or maybe the day before.
Or maybe the others were just too early.
Exactly. We're hitting it right on the nose.
Exactly. Right as 2024 is over, that's when we come up so we can look back on it. Even though that's not really how it works, but it doesn't matter.
Before we get into it, let's give the audience a little bit of a background on why we're so tennis obsessed. So what about you? How did you first get into tennis? And what's sort of your level of passion of tennis at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think I remember getting into tennis probably around 2009. I think it all started with the French Open that year. My dad was following Roger's quest for that French Open title that just seemed to elude him for so long. And finally, Nadal was out, and my dad made us stay up and watch all the games over. I was growing up in Hong Kong, so like the games would start quite late there, but my dad would be watching it, and I remember just joining him, watching Federer win through that run, and then watching the 2009 Wimbledon final against Roddick, seeing that crazy match that seemed to last forever and forever and forever with that final set. And then it all, cherry on top, Juan Martín del Potro won the U.S. Open. Being Argentinian, this was a huge, huge deal for me and for us. And, you know, from there on, started playing here and there. I definitely played a whole lot more squash growing up, hence my beautiful one-handed backhand that I have on the tennis court right now. But I can't say I really love to watch squash the way that I do tennis, you know, and I think especially now, given sort of the fame, it seems a rise in fame that tennis is having with these two young phenoms that we have now, it just seemed like it's just so, sort of rekindled the interest to a whole new level, the way that it felt like when it was peak big three era, you know, so it's just an awesome time to get into tennis. I think it's a perfect time with so many exciting athletes, right?
Exactly. I mean, I think this is the most exciting time in tennis since, you know, since the big three. And, you know, if we're talking about how I got into tennis, I played a little bit of tennis as a youngster, wasn't particularly good at it. But in terms of watching tennis growing up with the big three, you know, Federer was in his prime when I started watching tennis. And then Novak obviously went on an absolute tear at one stage and, you know, completely changed the game. I mean, those three completely changed the game together. We haven't really seen anything like that before in any sport, I would say. So, yeah, it's like, you know, and now you've kind of got that rebirth of players that are just so just levels of talent above everyone else on the tour. And that's just, you know, that you can't, now it's kind of like when I watch tennis, the level of play is just ridiculous. Like they're doing things that no one's ever done before on the court.
It's just magic. It's surprising to me that tennis hasn't picked up even more in popularity with the young generation, given it's like the perfect sport for sort of TikTok content, given that every time the ball is served is a chance of something spectacular to happen every single time. And I think that's what makes tennis so exciting. You never know when that ball is tossed up and served. You don't know if you're about to see either a double fault or the craziest rally you've ever seen. And it's what makes the sport so captivating.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely agree. So yeah, let's launch into this episode a little bit, because I think people will also get a better understanding of what we're like in the tennis world once we've done this episode. So this is going to be a review of the 2024 season, and we're doing it in the format of a bunch of awards. So those awards are as follows. We've got sort of the standard awards. We've got Breakthrough Player of the Year, Letdown of the Year, Upset of the Year, Match of the Year, Tournament of the Year, Player of the Year. So those are our standard awards that you'll hear on every tennis podcast. We can't do a review of the year without having those awards there. But then we're also adding in Best Drip and Outfits of the Year, Worst Drip and Outfits of the Year, the Best Hype Man on or off the court, male or female. And then we've got what you've so nicely dubbed the Nick Kyrgios Award, which is given out to the biggest crybaby pisspot. I've got a couple of other less nice words there as well, but I'm going to save those. And then we've got the best not directly tennis related moment that made you laugh, maybe it made you cry, but it was something in the season that you quite enjoyed. So that'll be our last award. But yeah, I think we got a good mix of some serious stuff and some not so serious stuff there. And that's what hopefully we're going to try do with this podcast as well, is that we're trying to break the mold of all these other tennis podcasts where it's just tennis.
Yeah, we're trying to make it feel like you're at home chatting with your friend about tennis, just chopping it up. Because we did find, you know, before we both realized that we both really like tennis, that it's not a sport that everybody necessarily watches or talks about. So sometimes it's difficult to find somebody who matches your level of excitement about the sport, but also understands all your silly internet lingo like we do. So, you know, that's what we're here to do. Make it feel like you're sitting right next to us on the couch, just chopping it up about lawn tennis.
All right, so without further ado, let's get into it. The first award, Breakthrough Player of the Year. Now this one, there's a couple levels to Breakthrough Player of the Year. You know, so we might have slightly differing answers on this one. We're also going for the serious awards, Player of the Year, etc. We're doing male and female winners, whereas our non-serious awards will have just one overall winner. So yeah, Breakthrough Player of the Year, like I said, this one differs in how you break through. You could break through into being a top 10 player. You could break through into someone that no one's ever heard of to being one, you know, talked about player on the tour. In saying that, I'm going to start with female. And I think there's only one option here as to who Breakthrough Player of the Year for the female WTA side of the draw is, and that for me is Jasmine Paolini.
It's got to be Jasmine Paolini. I mean, came out of nowhere, really, to finish a year ranked number 4. Her rise already started by her reaching her best ever slam result in Australia, seeded for the first time, so clearly she was on some sort of a trajectory in her career, which some would be quite, what's the word, like skeptical that she could make this sort of improvement, don't you think, given her age and her like her limitations to her game? You know, the fact that she is quite small means her service sometimes, it's not really much of a weapon, but look at where she got this year, right? Like it was crazy, wasn't it?
I think what you said there about that, it was quite unexpected, because she's I think 28, I want to say, which is, you know, you're in the what should be maybe the prime of your career, but at this point no one had really heard of her before. And yeah, like you said, started off with her best ever slam result at the Australian Open, I think a fourth round appearance there, and then just kept on going. Won a WTA 1000 event in Dubai, And what I like to look at as to just how significant of a year this was for her is her prize money evolution, or like the change in prize money that she's had.
She must have done her career times two or something this year.
I think more than double her career prize money. So her career prize money at the start of the year was $2.6 million, her entire career. And then by the end of the Wimbledon finals, that's about halfway through the season, she had already more than doubled that. And her end of year prize money for just 2024 ended at $5.8 million, which is more than double what she started her entire career with before. But yeah, just an insane year. Rank and climb from number 30 to number 4, and you know, that is the area of rankings where it gets really hard to keep moving up. Obviously, back-to-back Grand Slam finals.
Would have been nice if she left the year with one, huh? Would have been nice.
Yeah, because, I mean, as good as this year was, you know, you wouldn't bet on her to make... I don't know that I would bet on her to make a Grand Slam final next year.
Yeah, I mean, it's that. Yeah, it's quite interesting because for me, I thought the French Open final was a flash in the pan. And, okay, well, certain things went her way for her to end up in this position, but to follow it up immediately with a Wimbledon final, she rested those sort of concerns I had of, is this just like a hot streak that she just got really hot at the right time, had the right draw to make the final? But she made Wimbledon final as well, and she was the first female player to do that since Serena Williams in 2016. And you know, we've had some very good tennis players between then and now, and for her to be the first one, making her first slam final ever back to back, it was such a terrific year. And that's without even taking into account some of her double results that she had.
Yeah, if you add in the double stuff, it gets a bit absurd, to be honest. You know, reached the French Open final in doubles as well while she was making the singles final. And there she finished runner-up as well. So a bit of a tough one to take. But then won a WTA 1000 doubles title in Italy. What a place to do it as well for her and Sara Errani. And then a gold medal in that the Olympics. What an achievement that is. And then also winning the Billie Jean Cup. I mean, the accolades really piled up towards the end of the year.
Something for her, I guess, about playing in Italian soil or with an Italian shirt that just riles her up to an even extra level of insanity. But of course, she wasn't just, even though she is the first recipient of the, what we might dub eventually the Jasmine Paolini Award, given her crazy rise to the top of the rankings, there are a few honorable mentions, you know, that can be said. For example, I had Qingwen Zheng was one of my honorable mentions. I think Mira Andreeva also deserves a shout, given her year going to her first slam semifinal at age 16, I want to say she still was at the time. She might have been 17, but that still is crazy. It's not like it makes it less impressive. So, you know, but Jasmine Paolini had to be the winner of this award.
Yeah, this was one of those cases where it was, there could only be one, and it was Jasmine Paolini, I think, very clear. I also had Lulu Sun as an honorable mention. Again, that's a different kind of breakthrough for her because she, you know, went from being, I think, outside of the top 100 to sort of similar to where Jasmine Paolini started her year as, you know, a top 40 or 50 ranked player. So, yeah, absolutely crazy year for her as well. And she's a Kiwi, so that's awesome. All right, and then, so that's it for the women's. We're not going to go too much into the honorable mentions statistics-wise, because otherwise we could be here all day. So let's move on to the men's.
This one we might have a different one, right?
Yeah. I think this one's a little bit not as clear cut as the women's side of the draw. And I think, yeah, you have a number of different possible winners that did different kind of breakthroughs. So for me, I've gone for Giovanni Mapesci-Pedicard.
Okay.
The Frenchman.
The French phenom.
The French phenom, the serve bot, you know, he, I mean, he is, but he's also got a lot more to his game. So I haven't seen a lot of him play live, but I did watch a few highlight reels, and yeah, he definitely has a couple more weapons. He's a big hitter. I think he's got a bit of Joe Wilfried Tsonga energy, you know, gives me that kind of player, ripping one-handed backhand as well. But yeah, his season this year, hadn't won a tournament before, and then won the 250 in Lyon, which he entered as a wild card, defeated Echeverry in the final and became the lowest ranked champion in that tournament's history. Then backed that up with winning the Swiss indoors in Basel, where he beat Ben Shelton, which is nothing to be laughed at, because Ben Shelton is one of those players which is hyped up as possibly being in the future on the same level as Alcaraz and Sinner. So to beat him is huge. And then his ranking rise, 205 to 31, that is insane. Led the ATP tour in average aces per match with 19. It's crazy. And then his win-loss record, 48 and 25 for the year. And then on hard court and grass, he's obviously better than on clay. But I think Lyon.
Lyon is on clay, and he beat an Argentine, which, you know, I am from Argentina, and I know we are clay court merchants historically. So
exactly. I mean, you guys only do the French Open and then disappear for the rest of the year. So
I haven't seen anybody else play anything other than that. No.
Because you guys are such battlers, you know, you're not like, you just grind
it's
it
all
out
the
you don't
grit,
have
you know? I mean, look at our two most famous players recently have been short kings, and Diego Schwartzman and Sebastian Baez, and you know, you need to have a bit of dog in you to be successful as they are. But he's a great player. I think I noticed him at Wimbledon when he, I want to say, reached the fourth round, correct? It was like his best slam result. I remember watching him that French Open and being thoroughly impressed by, well, the serve comes out like a cannon. I'm pretty sure he has a faster serve than Ben Shelton. Maybe he hasn't reached a peak number like Ben Shelton, but in terms of consistency, like how often he gets it up, those crazy high speeds. And that one-handed backhand is sweet to watch. So I really like your shout.
Who doesn't love a one-handed backhand? And it's about time we get one in the top of the game that isn't Stefanos Tsitsipas, because out of all the one-handed backhands, his one isn't great to watch.
No, Grigor's is still great, and he's still...
I was going to say, yeah, Grigor's is still great, yeah. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to watching this guy next year. I think he's going to be someone to keep an eye on, and definitely someone that...
Could be a dark horse at some slams. Who knows? Depending how the year
goes.
Yeah,
who knows? Yeah. I think one thing that I did notice as well, he does still serve a lot of double faults. But I think that is also because he goes for it a lot.
I mean,
lot
he goes hard
second,
or
so
go home,
just
you know?
To,
he's like...
Yeah, yeah. Which is also fun to watch. Like, who doesn't love a second serve ace?
Exactly. So I have gone a bit of a different route for my winner for Breakthrough Player of the Year, because I've decided to go for somebody that to me completely broke through in my eyes, and I think in many people's eyes, into becoming a top player, and that is Taylor Fritz, my favorite American tennis player. You know, I
feel like you have a bit of a crush on him as well.
I might, just a little one. Maybe it's a Hugo Boss apparel that he's rocking, or maybe it's a Chipotle sponsorship, or maybe it's just him. I don't know. I can't.
I mean, we're not at best drip yet, but if we're talking best sponsors on the shirt, it's hard to argue with the Taylor Fritz branding.
He knows what's
up. The Chipotle.
He knows what's
the
up.
The Boss. He's looking good out there.
He's looking fresh. And, you know, I think that's exactly what carried him. No, I'm kidding. It wasn't his drip that carried him all the way there. But I think it was his consistency. He had consistently a very strong year. You know, he reached all career high points in all the slams, reaching quarterfinals in Australian Open and Wimbledon, fourth round in the French Open. He reached a U.S. Open final. I mean, it wasn't much of a match between him and Sinner, which is kind of an issue, it seems, for him to play that guy and Alcaraz. But doesn't take away from the fact that he, in my opinion, overachieved and really put himself at the forefront of American tennis.
I mean, and as well, it's not just him that struggles against Sinner and Alcaraz. I mean,
no,
Sinner got beaten by four people this year, and one of them was Alcaraz.
Yeah, exactly.
And three other dudes, you know? So I don't think you can be too harsh on him for that, but I think that's like the next level of breakthrough that he has to go through, is to get to that top level where he can get to a slam final and the general mindset around the stadium won't be, well, this will be a clean sweep for Sinner.
Yeah, because you know? That was definitely how the US Open final felt, even though he was technically the one with home court advantage. Well, I don't know, in New York, with all the New York Italians, I don't really know if he had much of a home court advantage.
Hey, Joey.
I don't think he had much of an advantage against Joey from, yeah, my family's from Italy, you know? So, like, you know, I think that, I think that it was an extremely impressive year, and to top it all off with a tour finals appearance, you know, also his best at the event. He had a tremendous year, and I'm not necessarily sure what this means for Taylor Fritz. Does it mean that he is now a slam contender for next year, potentially? But I definitely like to see where it is, where if he has a next level, because if he does, I mean, then it has to be slam winner, right?
Mm. I mean, personally, I have pretty high hopes for him next season that he'll at least be able to match what he's done this year. And I think that's also because a bunch of the players in that top 10 have sort of faltered around him. Or, if I look at someone like Tsitsipas or Casper Ruud, I think now Fritz has propelled himself past those kind of players. So I expect him to at least match what he's done this year. Maybe I wouldn't be disappointed if he doesn't get to a slam final, because making a slam final is always difficult. But I'm expecting at least a semifinal and consistent throughout the year.
Yeah, I think it would be disappointing now if he doesn't get to that now. It doesn't show why. I mean, he'll be a top four seed at the Australian Open, so if all things go well, he won't have to run into anybody too crazy until the semifinal. So,
well, where's Novak seated?
Yeah, he's going to be... That's kind of the big issue. If he doesn't run into anyone crazy, because he's got a little bit of a case of the jitters against Novak Djokovic. But who doesn't, right?
Brother, like, everyone has a case of the jitters against Novak Djokovic. I don't know if you can call it jitters. I think you can just call it Novak syndrome, because he's in crack.
Yeah. So, but you know, happy to see him here, and hopefully we see even more of a breakthrough. It's fun to have American players at the top, because they make a big deal about them in the US.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since we've had a men's US tennis player challenging the really top guys, right? Like, what, Andy Roddick was maybe the last one?
I would say, yeah, he was probably the last one where you would see him in slam finals and it wouldn't be a shock. So yeah, it's good to see him, but like we said, there are some other people that deserve honorable mentions. You know, I think Alex de Minaur is another player who broke through into the top 10, made himself into a consistent player to round out the year with a tour finals. Alexei Popperin, he won his first Masters 1000s title. You know, kind of a breakthrough if you want to look at it. He also took Novak out, I'm pretty sure, at the US Open, if I'm not wrong. So, you know, another little, a very impressive year.
Yeah, I had my honorable mentions. I had Taylor Fritz as an honorable mention. And then I had Lorenzo Musetti. Alex de Minaur, a really consistent year for him as well. I think just one, like Taylor Fritz, was one game off making every Grand Slam quarterfinal of the year, which is a really good achievement, and then obviously made the tour finals for his first time and won two ATP titles at Acapulco and Saratoga and Bosque. So a really good year for him. And by the way, Alex de Minaur, congratulations. Katie Balter and him are engaged.
Yeah,
well done.
Yeah, I did see that picture. It's very cute. It wasn't the only tennis player to get engaged this offseason. There were a bunch of them, I'm pretty sure.
Casper Ruud as well?
Aliassime. Yeah, I feel like he might have already gotten married. I don't know if they got engaged also.
Old news.
But there were quite a few. Casper Ruud or his engagement? I think give Casper a bit of a chance. Both. Come on. I'm still holding out hope.
All right, but let's move on to biggest letdown of the year.
30.
So, letdown of the year. You know, again, this is an award that could really mean anything when you think about it. It could be somebody that you had crazy high expectations for and they didn't meet them. Or it could be, I don't know, somebody that you just think sucked this year, even though maybe they didn't suck. Like, for example, maybe you think Novak Djokovic was a letdown because by his incredible standard that he set, you could see it as a bit of a down year, you know? So, who was for you your letdown of the year in 2024?
I'll start with female. This one was a bit of a tricky one for me to pick, but I've gone with Ons Jabeur.
All right.
Now, I don't know about you, but I kind of forgot she existed, and I think that speaks to how dead her year was this year.
Yeah.
Started the Australian Open as the sixth seed and then lost in the second round to Mira Andreeva, which is, you know, it's not the worst loss because we all know Mira Andreeva has incredible potential and she had a great year as well. Then at the French Open, reached the quarterfinals, which was her best Grand Slam result of the year, lost to Coco Gauff. And then Wimbledon, kind of her bread and butter, was defeated by Svitolina in the third round and then withdrew from the US Open with a shoulder injury. Had a few injuries throughout the year as well, which kind of played into this being a down year for her. But yeah, just not, even when she did play, she wasn't reaching the heights that she has in previous years and what we've come to expect from her. And she dropped from number 6 in the world to number 22. That is a big drop. And then finished the season 16-14 win-loss record. You know, just eking over the 50%, which is just, for someone that has become a fixture of the heights of the women's game in recent years, is really, really poor. So hopefully, you know, and I think Ons Jabeur is one of those players that is very well liked by both the players on the tour and the fans. So hopefully we do see her back again to the top of the game next year. But yeah, a big letdown year for her. And yeah, this one really only came up for me when I started doing my research into it because I just forgot that she was there, to be honest.
No, I agree. Yeah. I agree. I think that, you know, she's dealt with a lot of injuries, and I think especially last year being 2023, losing that Wimbledon final that I think she was a pretty big favorite for against Vondrousova, and then to kind of fall flat. It just kind of, I don't know if that was her last chance at a slam. I sort of want to say yes, but I hope not, because I really would like her to get over the line. I mean, Wimbledon would be ideal, but really any of them. And yeah, I think the only time I really saw her play inspired tennis was at the French Open, and she just happened to run into Coco Gauff, who is one of the world's best players. And when you're not on top form, you're not going to beat her. So it's a shame. It's a shame that that she's had to win letdown of the year.
I mean, if we're talking letdowns as well, you could also go to her Wimbledon final opponent, Vondrousova, also kind of fell off the map after that Wimbledon win. But yeah, let's go to you. Who was your female letdown?
I'm gonna let you finish yours, because I haven't gone for a player really. I've decided to go a bit more left field.
Oh, so you want me to do my men's one?
Yeah, you do your men's one as well.
Right. So you've done a combined thing here, right?
Yeah. Is that what's happening? Really let me down. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let me get into my men's. Okay. Let me do my honorable mentions for the women's first. I had Iga in there. That was until I realized that her down year is pretty much any other player's best, most illustrious year of their career. I had Emma Raducanu. Still just not, you know, it's about time she starts just, you know, getting the ball rolling a little bit. And it felt at times, I think why this felt like a letdown is because it felt at times that she was doing that and then just didn't really get there. Elena Rybakina, sort the immune system out, love. It is getting dire at this stage. It's really sad to see her constantly pulling out of tournaments because she is a great player to watch as well. But then also when she was well, had some disappointing results. The Wimbledon exit, when
yeah,
really
I think that
should have
that was, hers, hers to lose. Really, that Wimbledon. Yeah.
And then my last honorable mention was Naomi Osaka, just because she got my hopes up really high and then did nothing but wear a bow tie for the rest of the year on the back of her dress. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, those are my honorable mentions there. So I guess I'll move on to my men's as well. And yeah, you had a couple here that it could have gone to. I'll throw out my honorable mentions to begin with. I've got Holger Rune in there. Reason I didn't go for him is because his decline, if you want to call it that, has been a bit more of a two-year thing. But then also his results were not that terrible when you actually look into it. Like, if you compare them to what he was doing, yes, he won a Masters 1000 in 2022. But yeah, you can't, just because he didn't replicate that. But he's still reaching quarterfinals, semifinals, still taking out some big name players as well. So I didn't go for him. Stefanos Tsitsipas definitely could have won this, because he's just been sliding for a while now and needs to pull himself together. And kind of goes the same with my last honorable mention, Andrei Rublev, really needs to pull himself together as well and just develop his game, because you cannot win from the baseline when you just have a forehand and that ridiculous yell that he does every time.
Yeah, it sometimes it works, but yeah, no, it's not a consistent. He was the only one to beat Alcaraz and Sinner this year. Yeah,
you could say he's up there for number one player in the world then, if he's beating both the top two guys.
I mean, if you go by A eats B, B eats C, so A must eat C, then yes, Rublev is the best player in the world.
Essentially, he won a calendar year Grand Slam this year.
I mean, I think we need to start giving out that guy who beat both Alcaraz Sinner award, because only one dude did it this year, so it's quite difficult.
But my winner for letdown of the year for the male variety is Chris Eubanks. You know, another player who I completely forgot existed, and a player that after last season I was really looking forward to watching this season, and then just did less than nothing, like, I would say. I mean, his results in 2023, obviously a Wimbledon quarterfinal was his big breakthrough, and then he also won his first title in Mallorca, so big grass player, quarterfinal in Miami as well, third round in Shanghai. You know, other than that, there wasn't anything crazy, but then you look at his results for this year, and it is grim reading. You know, let me rattle off his first round exits, actually. Auckland, Acapulco, Indian Wells, Phoenix Challenger, Houston, Madrid, Rome, Geneva, French Open, Stuttgart, Mallorca, Wimbledon, Paris, US Open, and the Charlottesville Challenger. All first round exits.
Wow. Every single slam.
No, he made the second round in the Australian Open.
Oh, yeah. Australia was the other one. Yeah.
And he did win a Knoxville Challenger.
Okay, that's nice.
That's,
I haven't won the Knoxville Challenger, but
neither have I.
But I also didn't have the year that he had last year, which was a lot better.
Finished the season with a negative win-loss record, 27-28, 0-7 on clay. Like, I get clay isn't your thing, but brother, please try get one in there. You know?
Oh, and seven. Even Casper wins one match at Wimbledon every year.
Medvedev gets one on clay as well, you know? But he dropped from number 29 in the world to outside the top 100 at 107.
Yeah. Wow.
So, I mean, that is just...
I think you'd be surprised to find a bigger fall off in rankings, probably in just number, like quantity-based,
right,
this year.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason why I picked him as well is because I quite liked his play style and I was really looking forward to watching him play again. And then I got this. was a bit of a letdown personally as well. So yeah, those are my winners. Now, for your special little thing here that you've done, your combined winner for this. You've gone off script. What are you going to tell me
here? Yeah, so my letdown of the year was the image of professional tennis as a whole, considering that both two players that were number one in the sport at their respective tours, so Jannik Sinner and Iga Świątek, both tested positive for banned substances. In a sport that is so sort of embedded with its class, its dignity, and we're having such a rise in the popularity of it, I think it's just terrible timing for two of the sport's top players to pop for banned substances, you know? And I'm not here to tell you if I think that they're innocent or guilty. Like, as far as I'm concerned, the bodies that deal with all of this stuff, they got it all sorted and they came to the best solution and they're doing their best with the situation. I'm glad that both Iga and Jannik Sinner could clear themselves, although Sinner's is still a little bit up for debate because he could still serve a pretty lengthy suspension depending on how the whole WADA appeal, the World Anti-Doping Agency appeal, turns out. But, you know, it's just terrible because can you imagine, say, in any other sport, if, I don't know, say right now in football or soccer or however you call it in your parts of the world, but say Messi and, I don't know, Alex Morgan or one of these big superstar players both within the same year tested positive for a banned substance. Whether you think that it helped enhance the performance or not, there was enough there for it to appear. So I think just that was kind of a letdown for me, sort of the image of the sport.
Were you more let down by the actual positive tests themselves, or was it more the way that the respective governing bodies reacted to that and the response that they had to that?
I mean, definitely there's a little bit of both to it. I think when you hear of the positive test, especially players, you know, two top players that I really enjoy watching and I like their game, it certainly can put an asterisk into what they accomplished this year, you know. And for me personally, it doesn't do too much because, like I said, they've been proven innocent by the respective governing bodies that take these decisions. But it's still a little bit like, oh, that sucks. Like, really, like, this guy is so good and he tested positive for a banned substance. Like, regardless of how little was in his system, it still was enough to appear. So and then, yes, of course, it showed that that just comes down to resources. Of course, the world number one players are going to have much better resources than somebody who tests positive within the top 300, you know? So it showed that inequality in the game, but yeah.
Yeah, for me, it was more the lack of transparency from just about everyone involved, because, you know, had they come out and they straight away and said, Sinner has tested positive for this and that, and we're going to suspend him for this long. But it was all very veiled and very secretive. So, yeah, I understand why they did that, because it's their biggest star, but you just shouldn't do that. That's, you know, let it be out in the open, let the public and the fans also give them some respect and let them make their own conclusions from it as well, instead of hiding it for so long and then coming out with it and sort of trying to sweep it under the rug, if you will.
Yeah, and I mean, it's tennis also has to be the first sport where your athletes serve a suspension at a time where they're not playing. Like, Iga is technically serving her suspension now. It's like, okay, but what event is she suspended from? Like, none of them. The United Cup, yeah. Like, she can't go play at the United Cup. Like, I'm pretty sure Poland didn't even qualify, so it doesn't
matter. Hey, don't go bashing on my girl, man. Let her come back for the Australian Open. She needs all the slam practice she can get because she bloody sucks at them.
Yeah. Other than the one in Paris, yeah.
But, yeah.
But that was my letdown of the year. I didn't really have any honorable mentions because there were no other athletes that, Well, unless you want to, like, you know, Ryan Garcia tested positive for a bunch of substances, but that's boxing, and I'm not here to to, like, differentiate which doping violation was the worst of the year. So
that's your other podcast.
Where I just talk about steroid usage. So I mostly just talk about World Strongman competitions, and I go on and on about it.
Alrighty, I think we can move on. Thanks for that expose on the integrity of the
on drug
the tennis.
Cheats. I mean, on drug cheats. Integrity of tennis.
Alrighty, and moving on. Staying with the theme here, we're going with upset of the year. Let's go to men's this time. There were a few quite notable upsets towards the end of the year. What have you gone for?
I've gone for the biggest upset that was towards the end of the year. It was at the US Open second round, and it was when our countrymen, and we say our because we both live in the Netherlands, Bojic van de Zandschulp defeated Carlos Alcaraz at the US Open 6-1, 7-5, 6-4.
Wow. That pronunciation was really on point. Those Dutch lessons are really...
Hey, they're working out. They're working out. This is, you know, I've been really practicing this one in front of the mirror, making sure I got it right, because I didn't want to say this guy's from the Netherlands where we live, and then I absolutely butcher it, you know. So.
Yeah. No, I think this was one of those cases of there can only be one winner for this award. There wasn't really, I mean, there were a few other ones, but this was really like out of nowhere, and the fashion in which it happened, the fact that it was straight sets, and you just have this mindset when someone like, oh, by the way, this is my winner as well. When you're watching someone like Carlos play someone like Bojic, you're thinking the whole time, even when he's down two sets, like, ah, yeah, he's got this, you know, like he's because he's got players like him, Federer, Sinner, Djokovic, they all have that champion's aura, right? Where it's, they could be down a set and a break, but you're probably still chilling. But then it just he never came back. He just lost.
and it also was like, you know, rewatching sort of extended highlights just to sort of get into that space again of how big this upset was at the time. It's just also the way that Bojic played. Like he was playing so well, and then I watch him play again that well at the Davis Cup when he had to beat Nadal in Nadal's final match. It's like the guy just really got up for it both those times, because I've never watched him play before and been like, oh yeah, this guy can absolutely wipe the floor with Carlos Alcaraz, you know. I never saw that flair in him. And yeah, okay, like Alcaraz wasn't in great form coming into it, but still, considering, like you said, like, you just, at slams, you know, if this would have happened at a Masters 1000, it would have still been shocking. But the fact that it's best out of three, like, you know, you lose the first two sets, you're done. But the fact that, yeah, he was down two sets to love, and I was like, oh yeah, it doesn't really matter. He's going to come back and win this. And then he didn't. He just lost. Like, it was
crazy.
Yeah,
I think as well, like, When I didn't watch the game live, but when I watched the replay or the highlights, man, the air just is completely sucked out of the stadium when he loses. Like, it's just, everyone is, there's genuine shock and surprise when it happened. And I think that's how you know it's a really big upset when that happens.
Yeah.
Honorable mentions, I had Alexei Poprin over Novak Djokovic in the third round of the US Open. I think this one didn't hit as hard because Novak had such a year that it was like he had such a, it's like he wasn't really there. Like, he was there for the Olympics, and then he's like, well, I'm back on holiday now, I'm going back to my TikTok era.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't really feel as big. I agree.
No, I didn't really, I also didn't really expect him to challenge in the US Open for some reason. Like, I never really had him as, I always thought Sinner was going into that as the overwhelming favorite. So I wasn't that shocked when he exited. I mean, a little shocked, obviously. Third round is crazy for Novak to go out in a slam. But then also, Novak appears my other honorable mention, which is Luka Nardi beating Novak Djokovic in Indian Wells. Was it the first round or the second round?
Yeah, I think it was the second round. That one definitely had the... the bigger shock value, because it was the start of the year before we had knowing what was going to happen with Novak's year. So there I was like, whoa, like something is different this year. That loss to Sinner wasn't just like, it wasn't just like a one-off, like he might have a down year this year.
That's when you first start thinking like, oh, maybe this guy is human. Maybe he will start to deteriorate eventually and not win consistently three slams a year, you know?
Yeah, and make the final of the other as well.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the men's ones. Now for the women, what have you gone for?
So I went for one that I think is maybe less shock value in terms of the players involved, but I think with the context, the fact that Qing Wenjiang defeated Iga Swiatek at the Olympic semifinal 6-2, 7-5. You know, it could have happened. Qing Wen had already established, she'd already been to her first slam final. She'd established herself as a top 10 player and a legitimate threat on the WTA tour. But the fact that Iga was playing on Parisian clay, somewhere she hasn't lost since 2021, an overwhelming favorite to win the whole Olympic event. You know, you could see how much it meant to her. Her dad was an Olympian and it was like her dream to bring a gold medal to Poland. And the fact that Qing Wen, it was a very competitive match, but she still was on, she had her foot on the gas the whole time and then would go on to win the Olympic gold medal, made it all that much bigger of an upset and sort of a seismic result of like, oh, okay, like she really is here to compete and be a part of the top of the WTA tour.
Yeah, I mean, I've got the same game, actually. And I'm surprised that you say that it didn't hit in sort of the shock factor, the shock value, because I thought this had, this was a huge shock to me. Like, it was, I mean, obviously, I agree with what you say as well, that what added to it was the fact that, you know, Iga has been so dominant on that surface and on that court, especially. And then the fact that Qing Wen also backed it up by going on to win the gold as well. But I think that going into this Olympics, Iga was overwhelming favorite. And then you also have the aspect of you never, like, the Olympics are not every year like a Grand Slam is. You know, you maybe as a player, if you get four cracks at it, you've done very well. You know. So for it to be on a surface that you haven't lost on in 3 years and you bottle it, that's brutal. Like I think that's why, you know, she was so, part of plays into why she was so distraught as well, is because she knows that she will never get a better opportunity than this.
The next Olympics are in LA, so they're definitely going to play some form of hard court, whether indoor hard or outdoor hard. Like, she's the queen. It's literally, it does have a bit of like, if the Olympics would have been in Paris and Nadal would have lost, you know, and you're like, right. What? Like, what do you mean he lost?
Very sad. Yeah, I think that's very much the equivalent that you could make. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a huge result, but there were a few others. I think for me, a big one was Vlinkova defeating Rybakina in the Australian Open, in that crazy long, I think longest tiebreak in the history of women's tennis at the end. Just because Rybakina had come into, she started the year so hot. She was Australian Open finalist the year before and had come just one set away from winning her second slam. Like, I did not see her losing so early on in the tournament and in that fashion as well. Just so drawn out. It was a great match as well.
Yeah, I've got another Australian Open one. I've got Noskova beating Iga in the Australian Open third round. And then my other one was Barbora Krejčíková beating Rybakina in the Wimbledon semifinal after being a set down.
Yeah.
That one was quite jarring to me also because we've said it already, that should have been Rybakina's second slam right there. And she bottled it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Let's now move on, instead of upset of the year, to what was our match of the year. Alright, now we can move on to our match of the year award. This one, could have been a f could go either way. You know, we just did the ATP, so let's start with the WTA match of the year. So Jason, what was for you the match of the year on the women's tour?
I've gone with the Wimbledon semi-final between Jasmine Paolini and Donna Vekic. This was a tough one to pick. There were a lot of good WTA games this year. I think with the WTA tour, because you have players like Iga and Saba and Rybakina who are often levels above a lot of players that they meet in like the first four rounds of a Grand Slam, you get a lot of like six love, six ones, or if you're Iga, six love, you know, like I don't know how many bagels she had this year, but it was a fair few. But then when you get an entertaining match, my God, are they entertaining. Like, it's so this, you know, this semi-final, the longest Grand Slam, or the longest women's semi-final in Wimbledon history, went to the tiebreak in the third, 10-8. Paolini took it in the end. I think as well what made this one so good was the level of emotion that was on court. Both these players wanted this game so badly. You know, Donna Vekic coming back from, you know, almost retiring because she just couldn't get any results, and now this, and then ended up getting a what did she get, a silver medal at the Olympics?
Yeah, at the Olympics. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, silver medal at the Olympics. So a fantastic year for her as well. But yeah, this game was crazy. Like towards the end, there were so many swings where it looked like it would go one way and then the other. And I love that in a tennis match. I also, yeah, the fact that Donna Vekic was sort of crying on court in so much pain and just willing to just keep going was such a crazy thing to see. So that is my winner for this one.
No, it was an awesome match. It was definitely probably my favorite slam match of the year across both tours. I think it was with the stakes and everything, it was just amazing. But my winner was actually Iga Świątek defeating Aryna Sabalenka at the Madrid 1000 final. 7-5, 4-6, 7-6, 9-7 in the final game tiebreak. It was the first meeting of the year between world number one and two, and it's definitely a matchup that we don't get to see as often as you would like, perhaps, just because at the slams, they never seem to meet each other in finals, and since they're one and two, it's really the only time they're going to meet each other, and they still haven't met in one, so I think it's always feels like a big spectacle when these two meet, and the fact that Iga saved three match points in a 3-hour, 11-minute final, it was just like a mammoth effort from both women. I think it also showed that Sabalenka can trouble Świątek on clay. I mean, Madrid clay, they say, is one of the fastest on the tour, but it's still clay, still where Iga has a historic record. And I think it was great to see that Sabalenka can push her there. And this would also signify the start of Iga's historic clay season, winning the dirty double of both Madrid and Rome, and then the French Open. She only lost two matches on clay all season, and one of them was the Olympic semifinal we talked about, and the other was an indoor clay event. So that's also very different. So yeah, I just think that this was an awesome, awesome match between the two best players in the world.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I watched that one live, and I was on the edge of my seat for most of it, especially that last tiebreak. Yeah, what a game. What a game. And I do have that one in my honorable mentions as well. And I'm going to rattle off my other honorable mentions as well while I'm at it. I've got Blinkova beating Rybakina 6-4, 4-6, 7-6, 22-20 in the final set tiebreak. What a game. And then I've got Iga beating Naomi Osaka in the French Open second round.
Yeah, that was also in my honorable mentions.
Yeah, 7-6, 1-6, 7-5. And then the Madrid 1000 final. And then also the WTA finals final between Kim Nguyen and Coco Gauff, which was 3-6, 6-4, 7-6. That one was also great, and I think that one as well, the level was just incredible.
Yeah, from both women. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what makes these matches so great, seeing these players just play at their highest peak against each other at the same time, which is exactly what we had on the ATP side for this award, at least for me, because my match of the year was the Olympic final between Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz that finished 7-6, 7-6 in Novak's favor.
I am right there with you. Yeah, there were two games for me that were in the running for this, but this one edged it out. So, yeah, just the level, right, was just insane.
Yeah, I think both were... They were both on such a tear. They hadn't lost a single set all the way to the Olympic match. Like, it just seemed like a collision course, especially after we had seen the Wimbledon final, where Alcaraz absolutely wiped the floor with Novak, and Alcaraz, you know, coming off the Channel Slam, just playing out of his mind during that summer, and just looking like untouchable again at the Olympics, and Novak playing, also looking untouchable all his way to the final, and then to get the match we did. I mean, that might be the best straight set victory I have ever seen in my life.
The Wimbledon final or this one?
No, this one. The Olympic final. Like, best in terms of like how competitive it was.
Right, right. Yeah, it was... I was the only thing that lets it down is that it didn't go to a third set. Like, had we got a third set in that one, I would have lost it, because it was just, the level of play was ridiculous. Every point was just two guys just like hurling everything they had at each other, and it was so good to watch.
Yeah, and to finish it with Novak with two back-to-back forehand winners, like that, he's putting it right on the line. So precise, and like just going all out for it, and watching him collapse and finally getting that one title that had eluded him for so long. It, the context mattered, and the context almost made me cry, so it had to win match of the year.
Yeah, right, Djokovic fanboy over there. I 100% agree with everything that you said. Like, it's just it was just a crazy match, and it was so good to watch. I hope we get something similar in this next year. But my honorable mention was I think the only match that got close. I've actually got two honorable mentions, but one is for different reasons. My first honorable mention, which is the one that I would consider very close to this one in terms of level, was the Beijing final between Alcaraz and Sinner.
Also have that one.
Yeah, 6-7, 6-4, 7-6. Just this, when I say that, like, the new guys are doing things that we've never seen before, this match pretty much exemplifies exactly what I mean. Like, it's just, they were everywhere around the court. They were doing ridiculous stuff that you've never seen anyone do with a tennis ball or on a tennis court. So, yeah, and then my other one was the Wimbledon final, Alcaraz wiping the floor with Djokovic, just because that level of dominance against Djokovic is unheard of, and it was so... Yeah. I've never seen a player as on it as he was that day.
No, yeah, I think both very fair shouts. I also had the Alcaraz Sinner final. For example, I think if somebody were to be like, oh, show me why you like tennis, I would probably show them this match over the Olympic final, just to tell them, like, this is the future and the present right now. Like, if you get into tennis right now, this is what you're going to get for the next 10 years, hopefully. And my other match that I had was Medvedev defeating Zverev in the Australian Open semifinal. Him coming back from two sets down, it really seemed like Zverev had it all figured out and he was going to go to his second slam final. And for Medvedev just to come back, just to claw his way back into that match and win it in the end, it was surreal. So I think it's time now that we've had our matches of the year to move on to our tournament of the year.
30. Okay, tournament of the year. So this one, we're not just looking for one standout match. We're looking for, you know, a tournament that had everything, hopefully. All right, I'm going to throw it back to the men's. What was your tournament of the year for the men's?
I mean, my tournament of the year coincides with my match of the year, because for me, the tournament of the year was the Summer Olympics. I think I had the best match of the year. I think it showed the level that Novak Djokovic can still produce when he wants to, and that Carlos Alcaraz has in general. The only thing it was missing was that Sinner was unfortunately injured and did not participate, but I would have loved to see Sinner in best of three format sort of with a title as big as the Olympics. I think that Musetti's run all the way to a bronze medal was super fun. Him coming out, the match between him and Zverev was really, really good with Musetti winning. We had the final Nadal versus Novak Djokovic meeting of all time. And even though that one wasn't much of a match, there were still moments in it that reminded you of the greatest matches that these two behemoths have played against each other. So it just had a bit of everything. And it was the Olympics. The Olympics are every 4 years. So I could only pick, I can't pick this for the next 4 years. So, you know, might as well pick it this year.
Fair play. And I know that you were a bit of a hater on Grand Slam tennis this year. So I think it's a fair choice.
Yeah, could have been better, but yeah. I'm not going to get too into it.
Yeah. Which brings me to my tournament of the year for the men's, which was the Australian Open. I think it had it was quite good. It was quite good. The final was. the final was decent. I think it could have been better had both players been at their peak. I think we had about three games in the entire match where both players like level really converged at the same point. And then the rest, it was like the first two sets were Medvedev's, and then the tide kind of changed at about, you know, 3-2 in the third set.
Yeah, it was really a game of two halves, if you will. Like, first half Medvedev, second half Sinner, just steamrolling him.
So a couple of points about the tournament itself. A record-breaking number of first-round matches that went to five sets. 20 matches in the first round going to five sets is just...
That's crazy, man. That's insane amount of matches. That's crazy, bro.
It's crazy. And then Medvedev was like, well, I'm not just going to do it in the first round. I'm going to keep doing it for the entire tournament.
He was like, I'm in Melbourne only once a year. I want to stay here for as long as I possibly can.
Exactly. And that's what he did. He was like, I'm going to play an entire day of tennis throughout the tournament. So he played 24 hours and 17 minutes en route to the final. I believe, I want to say four or three five-setters in a row. Yeah. I don't know why he decided to put himself through that.
I remember when he was playing Rusevori. I'm not sure in which round, but it was early on, and I remember watching it, and we were both watching it, and just texting like, oh my god, he's down two sets to love, and then just suddenly cruising through, and then doing that again, like coming from two sets to love down twice in the tournament. And then just to have it happen to you in the final, like, I think he used up all his karma, like, on the way to the final.
But he's going to be gaining karma very well, though, because now he's lost... I think he's the only person to lose two Grand Slam finals from two sets up.
Yeah, I think I... Yeah, I mean, he has to be shortly. Like, I don't...
His karma
don't
points
know.
Have got to be through the roof.
Yeah. But maybe that's bad karma for all the shouting he did getting to this point in his career.
But that's funny. Calling the chair umpire a small cat is...
Oh, it's undefeated.
That's good karma in my books.
Undefeated.
Also, the tournament itself had a record-equaling number of five-set matches with 35, tying the record which was set in 1983 at the US Open. So, yeah. I'm a sucker for a five-set match. I love it. Like, a comeback from two sets down.
Hey, you can't... Hey, That's fair enough. Gotta love a good comeback story.
All right, women's. What do you have?
So I have gone for the U.S. Open, actually, because I felt like it was just a really fun tournament to watch. Sometimes the U.S. Open can feel like a bit of a dud because everybody's super tired and it's super hot in New York and you get weird matches. Like last year when we had, or even this year, actually, I don't even need to go to 2023, when Sinner played Jack Draper in the men's side, and they're both looking like they're about to pass out, and Jack Draper is puking all over the floor. But on the women's side, it was great. There was a lot of upsets, new players rising to the top, like Emma Navarro, Jessica Pegula making her first slam final, some old players coming back, like Paula Badosa making a quarterfinal. Caroline Wozniacki making the fourth round. I think Mukova showcased why she's one of the most exciting and entertaining players to watch when she's on it, because she is just on another level with her creativity, her shot making, her hands. I think she's awesome. And we had two really good semifinals and a really competitive final between Sabalenka and Pegula, which I think for Sabalenka to win, it wasn't like you didn't have to be a genius to predict that, but it was definitely a lot more competitive than I thought. And it was great. I love Aryna Sabalenka. She's my favorite player on the women's side. And it was nice to see her finally break that US Open curse, which I mean, before she had a slam curse, but then once she won Australia, it just seemed like the US, especially after last year being a setup against Coco Gauff and then losing, I'm glad she broke that duck. So now she can sort of just go into every slam feeling like she can win any of them. So it was awesome. I had a great time with the US Open.
That's I think that's a good shout. Yeah.
What have you gone for? Do you have a slam as well for this?
No, I haven't gone for a slam. I've gone for the tour finals at the end of the year. And I think the main thing that did it for me was that the level of tennis on display here for the women's game was really high quality for me. I thought the players were doing really, really well. And then it was a bit of an upset as well. I didn't expect Coco Gauff to play as well as she did. That gives me hope that she'll actually, you know, take this into some slams next year, because I think some of her performances, especially when you compare them to how she played here, I mean, her serve was popping, her forehand was popping, all the things that she's normally not good at, she was doing in this tournament.
I agree, yeah. Yeah, she was great.
Yeah, I thought the level of play was just fantastic for a women's tournament. I don't know if the court had an impact on that. The fact that it apparently was a really fast court, maybe that made it a little bit more exciting to watch for the women's game. But yeah, a couple of tidbits. Gauff, the first American to win the tournament since Serena Williams in 2014, the youngest to win it since Sharapova in 2004, and the youngest player to beat number one and number two in the same tournament, also since Sharapova in 2006. And took home a record-breaking amount of prize money for a women's tournament at $4.8 million US.
Let's go, the Saudi Kingdom.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah, that's a discussion for a different podcast.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I mean, that was in my honorable mentions, I have to say. The other tournament I had was Wimbledon. I feel like I do like Barbara Krejcikova, but I really wanted Jasmine Paolini to win. And if she would have won, I think that would have been my tournament of the year, to be honest. But I think it's time now to move on to the best award, the one they've all been waiting for, the Player of the Year.
30.
And with it, we get to our final award, the most prestigious one of them all, the Player of the Year. Let's start with the WTA Tour. Who was your WTA Player of the Year this year, Jason?
So, my Player of the Year, WTA, I think both of these, pretty clear-cut, men's and women's side, I'm going with Aryna Sabalenka.
Yep. Her best year, for the same. I'm going to spoil it. I went for the same.
Exactly. I mean, the men's one, we'll get into it in a sec, but I don't even know that we need to reveal who it is. But yeah, two slams, a cracked hard-court season, 56-14 total record, also while going through an absolute horror show off the court. 11 wins against top 10 players, victories in Australia, Cincinnati, US Open, and Wuhan. Also, like, Madrid final, Rome final on clay, not bad.
Honestly, in my opinion, was gonna make the French Open final because she was playing out of her mind. And then she got injured. I think it was something with her stomach, like some sort of abdominal something that kept her even out of Wimbledon. So You know, that's another slam that, I mean, she was my favorite for Wimbledon if she was going to play. So, you know, that's, she's really showing that she's very versatile tennis player. Like, she can, she's just performing at such a high level when it matters now.
Yeah, and when she is at her best, she's just, she's untouchable. Like, she's got that, like, when she plays her best on clay, she has similar kind of results to what Iga has. I mean, sorry, when she plays her best on hard court, she has similar kind of results to what Iga does on clay. Didn't drop a set when winning the Australian Open. She dropped only 31 games the entire tournament. It's just... That is just ridiculous. Didn't lose a set when winning Cincinnati either. Lost just one on the way to the US Open. And I love the fact that her forehand is the most powerful on both men and female sides of the tour. She just whacks the shit out of that thing and just doesn't apologize for it at all.
I mean, that's why I love to watch her. Like, it's just power and just big hitting. And like you said, when it's going in every time, it's unstoppable. It's unstoppable, for real. And she's just so impressive. And I can't wait to see what 2025 has for her. Like you said, she had an insanely difficult year with everything that happened in Miami. And then getting injured during both the French Open and Wimbledon. You know, also the whole Olympic cloud hanging over her that she can't represent her country. So what's the point of competing and so on. Really, really impressive year. But there were a few honorable mentions. You know, for me, I think Qingwen Zheng was up there, given her sort of breakthrough year / consistency that she showed. And I think Iga Świątek, although I think now the clay court merchant, or at least the clay court slam merchant shouts, are getting louder and louder each year as she continues to not do really well at any slam except the French Open. She still had a ridiculous year by the standard of any tennis player. She was insane. So she has to be up there for me too.
Yeah. Yeah, I had Iga, Kinwin, Coco, and Jasmine Paolini as my honorable mentions.
Yeah, fair. All fair shouts. Mm. And now let's go maybe to one that's even more obvious, the ATP Player of the Year. I think we can both say it in 3, Chef, 2, do- 1...
Yannick Sinner. Nice. Yeah. No, there was never any doubt with this one. This guy had one of the you know, most dominant years that I can remember on the ATP tour. 73-6 record for the year. 3 of those losses against Alcaraz. That's probably his only blemish on the year, is that
right? That he couldn't beat him once this year. Like, it's got like, I know that their off court relationship seems to be very good. I'm like, they don't seem to be like best buds, but they have a lot of respect for each other and they seem okay to be together and hanging out together. But that one's got a sting that he couldn't beat him this year, despite, like, he had the 9th best all time win percentage in a season at 92.41%. Like, that is a top 10 season of all time. Like, that is an all-timer season from Jannik Sinner.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good way to describe it, is an all-timer season. You know, he's one of just 6 players now to surpass the 11,000 ATP ranking point total. And the only other players in there, Pistol Pete and the Big 3 and Andy Murray. So you're among pretty darn good company there. And he's got a gap of 4,000 points to Zverev in second. Oh, sorry, just under 4,000 points to Zverev. And then the fact that he didn't do worse than a quarterfinal in a tournament the entire year, you know? His worst, that's insane. Like,
that one, and the fact that he, first man since Federer, I think, in 2005, to not lose a match in straight sets in any of his losses, also a ridiculous achievement. Like, you're telling me you didn't have one off day that you didn't lose in straight sets?
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's insane. And then, yeah, also 8 titles as well, among them 2 slams and the tour finals as well. Just
3 1,000s, yeah. First man since Ivan Lendl in 1986 to win the ATP finals without dropping a set. He was on another level. I mean, there was You could see it already last year when he had those close matches against Novak in Turin at the ATP Finals, including beating him in one of them, and then unfortunately losing the more important one in the final. But it just seemed like this year when they got there, I was like, yeah, nobody's going to beat this guy. Like, there's no chance. And won the Davis Cup as well, back-to-back Davis Cup champion. Yannick Sinner is, I didn't lose a single one of his singles matches or doubles, so you know, he was just on a different level this year. The last man to take a set of him was Tomas Martín Echeverri in Shanghai in like the first round or something. That's the last time he lost a set. Like, he's just so on it.
Bonkers. Absolutely bonkers, yeah, from Yannick Sinner. And with that, I think we can wrap up our serious awards and move on to something far less serious, but I think just as important. Best Drip Award. I'm going to lead us off. I think I've got two possible winners here. They're both American. Coco Gauff, Taylor Fritz, they're my go-tos for this one.
Hard to disagree, given like we've already explained that. I mean, whatever Coco Gauff has cooking with New Balance, keep cooking it, because every time she walks onto the court, I want to buy those pair of shoes. Whatever shoes she's wearing, I want them. They're awesome every single time. I've gone a little bit off, you know. I think kit-wise, I think Marta Kostyuk wearing her wedding dress-inspired outfit made by Wilson. I want to say she wore it at Wimbledon. Really cool to wear like an outfit that she says it's what my wedding dress looked like. Cool. I think Frances Tiafoe wearing a Charlotte Hornets jersey at an exhibition against Alcaraz. It just looked cool to see him wear like a basketball jersey. Novak's photo shoot with Lacoste after he won the Olympics, where he's looking like
that was very drippy.
Yeah, it looks like he went into Alcaraz's wardrobe and was like, "What do you have, kid?" and just put it on.
Also, so, I think someone hired him a new publicist, a new stylist, everything, because he's changing the image. He's changing the image completely. Like, it's he's done a 180. I'm even starting to like him, and you would, if you asked me even a year ago, I would have been hurling insults.
I've always been a bit of a Novak little.
I love
a good dog. You
know? He is a dog, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, even though we did have some of the best drip this year, there was also some worst drip, and let me lead it off. Worst drip, Carlos Alcaraz at the French Open. I think there's components of the outfit that make sense together. I can see that you're looking it up now, and you're probably going to say, hey, it's not too bad. And it's not. But my issue is that it has a lot of components, and none of it makes kind of sense together. Like, why is he wearing those socks? Why is he wearing that color of stuff? Like, it's not the worst outfit, but it's just a little bit too much, and I feel like it could have looked cool, and it didn't.
So this is like the gray with the yellow pants, am I right?
Yes, and then the white arm sleeve, and then the black socks, and then the white like the outfit itself is fine, but like, why weren't you wearing like a blue arm sleeve and maybe different color socks or shoes? Like, it's not the worst, but I just had issues with it. Like, when I saw him on court the first time, I was like, ugh, I don't really like that too much. And then I would have to go for what has been called the best outfit in most tennis things. The Naomi Osaka bow outfit at the US Open. I'm sorry, I was not a fan of it at all.
This is my winner for worst outfit in general as well. I think just because it's different, just because you put a big bow on your butt doesn't mean that it's good. Like,
it also just seems so impractical to play tennis in it. Like, I don't know. I'm sure it was comfortable because it's made by Nike. So I'm sure that, and I'm sure she tried it on and practiced with it. But I just, like, I couldn't pay attention to anything else other than the bow. Like, I couldn't stop looking at the bow. Like,
I 100% agree. I thought it was the weirdest thing. Coming out dressed like a buddy Christmas present. You know,
yeah, and play, it wasn't even Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah, had it been now, like...
Oh, I'm all over it. Best trip. Best trip.
If you come out looking like a fucking candy cane, then yeah, like, go for it.
And that one was at the US Open, and I have to say, the other one that almost took, that for me is up there, was Jessica Pegula's armpitless outfit. Like,
oh, that was awful.
What, yeah. What was that, Adidas? Why are you giving her no armpits? Like, why are her armpits the only thing out? Like, her arms are covered, but not her armpits?
Like, it kind of looked like a, yeah, like a weird swimsuit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like that some engineer figured out, and they're like, oh, having no armpit like makes you faster. So like what is this? Like,
and then I've also got here kind of honorable mention anything that Barbara Krejcikova does.
Yeah, she's a bit dripless. Like, she's dripless. But I love Barbara. She's cool, but she needs to get her drip up.
I kind of think about like Hubie Herkash on the men's tour, you know, just
yeah, exactly,
just dripless boy, you know,
just void of drip, you know,
void of drip, exactly,
VOD as these kids say it, you know, he's void of drip,
exactly, not so skibbity toilet,
not so skibbity toilet at all from Barb's this year. but speaking of, you know, skibbity toilet, aka who's
no. No.
No. No. It's like, how do I transition from that? I think it's time now for our best hype man contender. You know, best hype man, hype woman, fan, coach. I've decided to go for Alex de Minaur's little fan, Paul, the guy who was at the French Open, I want to say. And he was cheering on de Minaur while he was wearing de Minaur's full kit. I got to say, Jason and I tried it. We dressed up exactly like de Minaur, and we went to watch a Rotterdam Open final. We did not get anything. So I don't know if because it's a cute kid or whatever, and a bunch of 20-year-olds doing it is not as cute, but at least we tried it.
I mean, to be fair, we weren't. I was wearing actually an Italian shirt while he was playing Sinner. so maybe that's my bad. But I was cheering for him a lot. Like, when in a stadium that had no one cheering for him. And I could tell he could hear us. Like, I was.
Oh, he definitely could. He won a couple points because of us.
Yeah, 100%. So, Demon, next time I'm at a game that you're at and you
free
don't
hat,
single
please.
Me out.
Free hat. You don't single me out, you lose a fan.
You just lost a fan. If you're not doing your post-match chat, if you win the game and you're not pointing to me in the crowd and being like, yeah, I heard someone up there, we're done. Friendship over.
Yeah, I think hopefully we get to see a little bit more of Paul in the upcoming events.
I don't want to see Paul. I don't care about Paul. A kid getting a little special treatment just because he wore some tennis clothes to a tennis match. Like,
yeah,
brother, you're going to a tennis
when
match.
But then when I do it, I'm a loser. And like, you know. Like,
yeah, apparently I have to dress up nice to go to a tennis match or something. But he gets to go in like his little tennis kit. Come on now. I bet he couldn't even hear him from the court. He just saw him and was like, just a little bit of PR. I'm not buying it. Yeah. I'm not buying it for a second. Get out of here, Paul.
Poor Paul, absolutely catching strays. but I think another one for me was maybe the whole relationship between Novak and Carlos. They just seem like they love each other so much.
That's what I've got.
Together, yeah.
Yeah, I think they're just so good. Both of them are so good with the crowd.
In different ways, too. You know?
In different ways, yeah. I mean, this is kind of Novak's personality change as well. He's changing the crowd to actually like him now as well. Why you would start doing that in the twilight of your career, I don't know. Why?
Like, well, because it's better to like retire and not have to deal with assholes like... You suck, Novak! Like, he's with his kids and wife and he's retired, so at least now he's having the
I
PR
will be
change,
there
you know?
Until the day I die. When he's playing de Minaur, I'll be hurling insults one way. I'll be screaming at de Minaur, telling
him
to give me a shout-out.
Go eat your kale pancakes, you loser! Like...
He's just going to have to deal with it. Everyone else will have turned, but I will still be a hater. So...
We'll turn you eventually. We'll turn you eventually. But speaking of haters, right? It is time for the Crybaby of the Year Award. aka the Nick Kyrgios Award. And I have decided to give the first recipient of the Nick Kyrgios Award to none other than Nick Kyrgios, because how are you, the biggest crybaby on tour, and you haven't played a single tennis match this year? But yet, all you did was cry. You cried about Yannick Sinner popping for steroids, and you have continued to trash this man who does not care about what you think at all, hasn't given you a hint that he cares. You dragged his girlfriend, who was your ex-girlfriend, into it as well. It's just not a good look anymore. I think it went from like, and I've, you know, it's enough of the whole like, oh, if only he trained a little bit harder, he'd be the best tennis player in the world. Shut up, man. He doesn't care. He doesn't train. I don't care. He hasn't really had a good result ever in his career other than the Wimbledon final. Like, it's not like he's heaps of 1,000s. Like, he's just a flash in a pan player who's obviously very talented, but until I see something that it sort of backs up his Wimbledon final, he's going to continue to be a crybaby. Like, how are you not on tour and yet such a crybaby?
I think it's a very fair shout. I think he was a bit of a shit this year. I'm getting more and more sick of him on comms already, or just of his cockiness on the comms, because he's, like you said, he needs to have something to back up his bullshit, and he doesn't. So yeah, I've gone for Andrei Rublev. Just needs to sort his shit out and stop having a whinge at everything.
It just sucks because when he's not doing the sort of big public outrage, which obviously stem from some sort of mental health issues and whatnot, but when he's not doing that, he's a very likable guy. But it's just, you know, getting in the face of somebody, of an umpire, and saying the things he said to them, whether he meant them or not. Like, this is not the image you want as a role model and a pro athlete to have upon young kids who are watching tennis and are watching you play. Like, this isn't the image that you should be putting out there. And it's a shame.
Yeah. If you wanna whack yourself in the face with a racket, then go for it. If you wanna, but you can't go like verbally abuse a line judge and think that's okay.
And then make a big rant about like, they have way too much power, man. This guy is just a line judge. Like, for all you know, you're going to hit him. Like, next thing you can do is hit him. Like, you know, like, he doesn't know. So, no,
he's,
I think it's
job.
A very fair shout. Yeah, he's just doing his job. I think it's a very fair
you know,
shout.
He's yelling at him, and then you're just yelling abuse at him. And the guy's just like, brother, I just work here, you know? Like, yeah. I don't know what you're on
Wendy's,
about.
This is a Wendy's, sir.
But yeah, my honorable, I had a couple honorable mentions for this one. The U.S. Women's Olympic team and Coco Gauff.
Yeah, that was a lot at the Olympics from Daniel Collins and Coco, and just the women's team in general seemed to be on a big, like, why is this happening to me sort of run.
Right. Because you're shit. You can't play. Yeah. All right.
Because it was just not your day.
Let's move on to the last one. The best non-tennis related match moment, something that happened within the tennis sphere, but like, you know, not tennis related. What have you got?
So I've gone for the bees guy at Indian Wells.
Sorry,
just that absolute, the bees guy, you know, the guy who came when all those bees were in the stadium. And he was wearing this like bee killer shirt or something like that, and no protection, just shades. And then as he's going up in the crowd, everybody's taking pictures with him, and like, you can just tell Vance was feeling himself, and he knew he was about to be a hero. And got rid of the bees. We got to see Alcaraz whoop Alexander Zverev. It was just a great day overall. That day at Indian Wells, and hopefully we get to see him again. Hopefully not because there's bees on the court, but just in general would be nice to see him. He's kind of a cult hero now.
B-man. Nice. I must have missed that.
You gotta go watch B-man. He's
B-man.
Really on.
Hey, let me do it now. Let me get a live reaction of me watching B-man.
Live reaction of B-man.
B-man, Indian Wells. Oh, shit. We don't have a producer here that we can, you know, just say,
hey Jamie, look this up.
Yeah, hey Jamie, pull that up real quick.
We don't have a Jamie yet.
Okay, I found a clip here. Am I looking for a guy with long hair
and shades? Yeah,
shades. And, and a vacuum cleaner.
I know, vacuum cleaner. That's exactly who.
What a unit! What a legend that guy is.
He's a legend, dude.
I mean, I'm not going up there, and
you know, hell no, man.
No, and if I'm trying to vacuum clean bees, I'm definitely not looking that cool doing it. I'm swinging and flailing, and then definitely running in the other direction. So, but look at him. He's cool as a cucumber. You know?
Oh, he doesn't care, bro. Like, I feel like, oh, they planted a bomb in the center of a city. That's who I'm calling to cut the wires, man.
Yeah. He's in the sun. There's not a drip of sweat. There's not a hint of sweat anywhere on his body. He is as I bet he smells great as well. Like, he's just
his body's just perfectly regulated. Like, I love the B-man. The B-man has got to be my favorite non-tennis related moment of the year for sure.
B-man, hell yeah. My favorite non-tennis related moment of the year was Novak's TikTok era and general goofiness throughout the year. I thought that was quite funny. Yeah. And again, this is playing into me softening up on him as well. I still plan to hate on him plenty next year and hope that he doesn't get a 25th slam. But I'll like his TikToks. You know,
Hey, his TikToks go hard. And yeah. A little kale pancake never hurt anybody.
I don't know that you can prove that.
I can't say I can. I've never tried it. Well, what am I, sick?
Kale pancakes like, kill, man. Don't be putting false information out there in the world. We don't want to...
Maybe forget about the kale pancakes. Novak, eat a muffin, brother. Come on, like it's not gonna kill you.
Eat a muffin.
But I think that that's it from us, right?
That wraps us up. Yeah, let's do it.
It's gonna be a bit of a long one, this first one, we think. But you know, we just wanted to make sure that you guys kind of get to know us, what we'd like to talk about. Our style and
right,
you know, if there's anything immediately that you think we can improve on or something that you completely disagree, you know, let us know. You can hit us on all our social media channels at Cross Court Conversations. Something this can just get recorded later anyways and added. And yeah, is there anything else you want to say, Jason, before we get out of here?
No, I think we've said just about enough. It's been too bloody long that I've been on this call with you. I'm currently in New Zealand, and I want to go outside in the sun.
Yeah, I can't blame you. And but yeah, thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you for our Australian Open 2025 preview, where we'll be talking about the first slam of the year.
Awesome. Thank you very much, guys. We will see you next time. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.